All right, we go to the phone. Let's give a nice warm Radio Vermont welcome this morning to Lou Salome. Lou is going to be participating in this event tonight. I'll be keeping him in check tonight at the Reporting from War Zones, Journalists Tell Their Stories from the Front Lines. This will be a panel discussion that will include a number of Vermont reporters that I told you about. Lou has done some incredible reporting. He's been a journalist for some 35-plus years and has reported from many war zones himself, and he's kind enough to join us live on the line this morning. Lou, how are you today?
Good morning, Mark. I'm fine, thank you. How are you?
I'm great. It seems as though you spent a good chunk of your career working out of Miami. So what was the connection between Miami and being able to report from some of these places you were able to report from?
Well, it's a sad and simple story. The Miami News was closed in 1988, at the very end of 1988. The Cox Newspapers Group, which owned it, based in Atlanta, they shut it down. And they offered me a couple of opportunities. One was to go to Washington to be a national political reporter, and the other one was to go to Jerusalem to be the Middle East correspondent for the entire 18 newspaper Cox Group. So that was an easy decision. I went to Jerusalem, stayed there for more than 4 years, and then moved to London to be the European correspondent. And from those two places, Mark, I went from Northern Ireland to eventually to Afghanistan, across Central Asia, the Middle East, North and East Africa.
Uh-huh. So you went into this with your eyes open. You knew you'd be covering some turmoil.
Oh, absolutely. And getting to learn and know the world, which I could not do if I were really in Washington and working in the United States, I would be learning about the United States, which I already knew a little bit about. And this way I was able to go and see the world I didn't know much about.
Well, one of the things that I'm curious to ask these Vermont reporters tonight is about what they did to prepare themselves to go overseas. So what did you just experience this, or what did you do?
Well, a couple of words to that. First of all, I was the editorial page editor at the Miami News for 10 years. That meant that I really kept up with foreign affairs, because we wrote a lot of editorials about foreign affairs, whether it's Europe, Asia, the Soviet Union, the Middle East, or wherever, or Africa. Then I knew, I read a lot and studied and kept up with those events. I have a master's degree in history. I studied history since the graduate school, and my family happens to be a very tribal family. From Syria. Both sides of my family came from a little village, a town in Syria, Woonsocket Island. So I have a pretty good understanding of the behavior that dominates in most of the rest of the world. So you have those three bases there.
Okay. And was the first conflict that you covered Northern Ireland?
No. It was more the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, because I was in Jerusalem. That was my base.
Okay.
And from there, of course, I went throughout the Middle East to Somalia, to North Africa, to Central Asia, the Soviet Union, and the post-Soviet Union. So the first conflict, I would say, was the first intifada, that is the Palestinian uprising against the Israeli occupation in the West Bank and Gaza Strip.
Okay. All right. Were all of these places that you covered totally different from all the others, or was there actually something common in the experience?
Well, both. They are different. Each place is different. Even if you're in the same region, the people are different, the circumstances are different, the history is different. You may have commonalities in terms of religions and tribes, and even in language and culture. But you still have differences in history and land and territory, which is often a very big cause of conflict. So there are differences, and they're the same. Now, the sameness comes in the form of tribal behavior. Tribal behavior being the things that bind people together and separate them. So that means tribes, it means religions, it means language, culture, land and history, all those things. People together to DNA to be part of something. And they also separate people. and cause conflict, and then you have outside intervention, which exacerbates the situation. Outsiders trying to gain some advantage and take advantage of the situation create problems, often war.
We just, it was interesting you mentioned that, because we just had a woman on this morning earlier who had done some traveling through Jordan and Syria. And the thing that she pointed out in Syria that struck her more than anything else was the strength of family.
That's pretty much common throughout that region. Yeah, family is very strong. Family and then larger tribe. Tribe meaning, you know, it could mean your religion. It can mean your ethnicity. Well, Syria is an interesting place because it's actually controlled by the Assad family, which is a small family in northwestern Syria near the coast. And the Assad family and most people around it are Alawite Muslims. They are Shia-related rather than Sunni, but they're only 14% of the population, which is roughly what the Christian denominations are. The majority of the people in Syria are Sunnis, and while they are in critical positions in the government, they do not run the government. So that's a very unusual situation. It's sort of like what Saddam Hussein was doing in Iraq, because he comes from a little... to Crete and his family and extended family, they were in control of the army and the government of Iraq for about 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the same kind of a situation. Your family is very important. So you have the Assad family, you have power. They made power. They got control of the army. Same thing with Saddam Hussein. Family. It was all centered on family and village. And in the book, it is like sort of a tripod. You have you have religion, you have tribe, you have family, and a very strong stool on which the strength of the people stand or sit.
We're talking with Lou Salami. He has reported from a variety of war zones, and is also, as you heard him mention, he's also authored a book. It's called Violence, Veils, and Bloodlines. So, Lou, as you watch what's happening in Egypt, were you ever close to a situation like some of these journalists in Cairo who have crowds coming after them?
Oh, yeah. This situation in Cairo is more Western than it is Middle Eastern, for example. It's right in front of your face. You can kind of see what's going on there. It's demonstrations, political demonstrations. Sometimes people get killed in those. Demonstrations. But the life of a journalist and the life and the world has changed in recent years, because people are more aware now, because of the technology, of what's going on around them, what's going on in the rest of the world. And the period when I was reporting, there was more trust through the late 80s and through the 90s and 2002. There was a lot more trust. People thought you were going to tell this story. And they told you their story in the belief that you would convey it accurately and totally. And now they know that their stories aren't being told totally. And if you don't tell a story totally, you don't tell it accurately. You know, you tell pieces of it, and it's not the whole story. And sometimes you just can't tell the whole story, because it's maybe not interesting, and you can't get it on the air, or you can't get it in the newspaper. It's a demonstration, you know. I mean, I've been in many situations like that, but it's more difficult now in a way because they know who you are. People there, they know you are. And if you're a television, you have cameras. You get in people's faces, and sometimes it's not done with a great grace. You know, that doesn't justify any violence against people, but it happens.
You think this is happening because people have seen these particular reporters' reports on TV or whatever and don't find them to be accurate?
I think that you have to look at it over time. It's not these particular reporters at this particular time, but it's what people come to understand over perhaps several years. They know of situations, and they see the reporting. And they say, "Oh, I was there. That's not what happens. I mean, that happens in this country." that happens with ordinary reporting anywhere you go. Somebody will say, well, I was there. That's not what I saw. Well, you know, the camera is a great thing, but the camera also captures a very small segment of what's going on. And often there's not a lot of explanation behind it. Or you have to stay, if you're the viewer or the reader, you have to stay with it in order to understand what's going on. That means you have to pay attention for a long period of time to grasp it. So it gets more complicated, I think, the more people know. And I think that's a factor everywhere. The more people know, the more they question.
When you were reporting in some of these places, were you on your own with a photographer, or how did that work?
Most of the time I was alone. Sometimes I would get to meet up with other journalists along the way, people I most of the time didn't know. And for safety or security or ease of travel, we would end up working together. That happened after the first Gulf War, for example. I met up with Martin Nangle, an Irish photographer who was working for the Associated Press at the time. He was from Ireland, and we met in Damascus. And our objective was the same. We were trying to get into Iraq after the Kurdish uprising against Saddam Hussein immediately after the first Gulf War, 1991, February, March, in that period. So I met up with him, and, you know, where are you going? I'm going into Iraq. How are you getting there? I don't know. Where are you going? I'm going to Iraq. How are you getting there? I don't know. So it made it easier, and then you get to share the Imodium along the way.
Right.
You know, when you get sick, I have Imodium, you didn't have it. Well, we shared the Imodium, that kind of thing, and we ended up spending a couple of weeks in Iraq during that time.
Quite a bonding experience, isn't it, sharing the Imodium?
Yeah, well, it's a survival thing, you know. And fortunately, I had a lot of it, but not enough to sustain us throughout the whole period of time that we were in Iraq. But it's something you learn to take with you. So, but a lot of the times, you know, I was alone in Bosnia. I was alone every time I went in there. In Somalia, I was with a fellow from Newsweek. I believe it was Newsweek for a little bit at the beginning, and then I was off on my own, and you learn as you go. I learned a lot from other journalists.
Right.
And now my fear is, who are these younger journalists learning from? There aren't a lot of people with a lot of experience from whom to learn. And in my case, I was really, really lucky. I remember being in Iran during Ayatollah Khomeini's funeral in 1989. It was the first trip I took outside of Jerusalem when I landed there. And I happened to hook up with two Norwegian journalists, one of whom had been in Washington for a newspaper in Oslo. The other one was a radio reporter in Amman, Jordan. Mm-hmm. And these are tall, fair-haired, light-skinned Norwegians, and everybody thought they were Americans. And here I am, a shortish, dark-skinned, olive-skinned, a Middle Easterner, looking like a Middle Easterner. And they thought I was sort of a cousin, an Iranian tribal cousin, which was fine for me and wasn't so good for them, they thought, because they were looked at as the Americans. And then we're running through the desert. I was running through the desert after Khomeini was being buried and his body fell off the litter in the burial compound where he was being laid to rest. And I'm running through the desert behind a man and a woman. The woman is completely garbed in a chador, an Iranian chador, so that only her face is uncovered. Her hair, her whole body is covered with this black garment. And she's running through the desert with, I believe it was her husband. I found out who they were later on. Anyway, and we get stopped by a young soldier. He's got a gun. He's a young guy. He spoke a little English. And he stops her because the wind from her running blew her head scarf away from her hair. So your hair's not supposed to show. So the soldier reached for her headdress to cover her hair. And she says, "Don't touch me. You're not my husband." I said, "Oh, baby, she knew her stuff. She studied. Mm-hmm. She knew what could and could not be done there." And he froze. This kid froze, and he just backed off. She covered her hair herself, and we went on to try to get to the helicopters. And while we were at the, we were fenced in, actually, the fence was locked. We were kept from helicopters. That's what we needed to get back to Tehran, because it was a long distance to travel, and the roads were clogged with mourners or Khomeini. So while we're there, they won't let us out, and we have to go back and file our stories on very primitive teletype machines that were very difficult to operate, and we had to get in line in order to use them. And they wouldn't let us out of the gated area. So finally there was, and I remember him very well, Jonathan Randall, who was a Washington Post correspondent who was based in Paris. And he starts raising hell, pushing the fence and rattling the fence. And then before you know it, we're all pushing the fence. We're going to knock it down.
Wow.
And they opened the gate to let us out. And now I learned that from Jonathan Randall at that moment that there's a time when you exert your authority or standing, whatever you want to call it. And we had, as foreign journalists, we had some authority there. Like, you don't want to do anything to us that's going to create ill will at this moment of mourning for the Iranian people, right? And that's what Jonathan Randall was playing on. And then they unlocked the gates, and we walked through, got on helicopters, went and filed our stories. So you learn from people as you go. Now, I was pretty well educated in terms of the history, the people of those areas, because, as I said, I had been an editorial page editor. I studied history. I paid attention to the people of the region and so on. So I knew a lot more than I think most do. But I still had to learn on the ground. I had to learn from things that are happening right before your very eyes. And that's what I did. Now I say, okay, the people going into Cairo, right? They're going into a report here. They're going to film. They don't have any background. Who are they going to learn from?
Mm-hmm.
How many people are there based in Cairo?
Right.
Nothing like there were 20 years ago.
That's for
there
sure.
It's not. There are offices, bureaus have been closed. A very few newspapers and television stations, radio stations, have people in permanent location in those places.
Yeah,
so there's nobody to learn from.
Yeah, I mean, not only have the journalists been heard on this, but I think that the general public has as well too. We'll continue our discussion with journalist Lou Salome in just a moment here. First, let me remind you about our good friends at Vermont Canoe, and they have a great idea for you. And the snowshoeing, according to Roger Hill, has never been better. If you're looking for a fun experience, we would encourage you to check this one out: the Cabin Snowshoe Dinner Trips. These start at the Round Barn Farm Inn in Waitsfield, where you meet with other guests. You pick up your snowshoes and a headlamp. You venture off into the nighttime, and you then snowshoe to this beautiful little cabin where the folks at Vermont Canoe have already been cooking a hearty Vermont feast for you. And so you can enjoy some great food, a little wine, and some friends, and some warmth from that wood-fired cabin. You finish that off with s'mores by the bonfire, and then you head on back home. So if you want more information, call our friends at Vermont Canoe at 496-5889, 496-5889. You'll find out more about them at vermontcanoe.com. Also, let me remind you about our friends at Jet Service Envelope. They would love to make it happen for you with personalized envelopes. Pick up your phone today and call them at 229-9335. You can also find them on the web at jetservice-envelope.com. They have calendars, they have nice big thick business cards, and a vast inventory of envelopes, many made from recycled paper. 229-9335, and you'll find them on the web at jetservice-envelope.com. Lou, one of the areas that we'll explore a little bit tonight with these Vermont reporters, they were all embedded. Would you have ever put yourself in a situation where you were embedded, and do you completely have to compromise if you do that?
No, I was never in those situations. I refused to do that, actually. One of the particularly harmful, if that's the right word, aspects of that is if that's all you're doing, then you're really not covering much of anything except how are John and Jane doing. They're from Burlington, and they're in the 204th Regiment. Look at the hardships that they're undergoing, and this is what they have to live through, and so on. And that's okay if you're doing other things, but when that's what you're left with, It's a very inferior way to go about reporting on what's going on in a zone where there's a war going on and where there are American soldiers involved. I just was fortunate. It never really came up much. There was an occasion where in Israel there was an invitation. I was in South Florida at the time at the Miami News on the editorial page, and they wanted to put together a trip for editorial page editors from South Florida. Well, I wanted to go on the trip, but I didn't want to go under the auspices of a government, so I refused. And the paper sent me on its own, which was perfect. I got to go, and I talked to Israelis, Palestinians, and did the thing in a total kind of way, and it worked out fine. But I would have been very uncomfortable if I were, in that sense, embedded under the auspices of a government. That wouldn't have worked very well at all. But that's what we're left with, I'm afraid. If there are no bureaus and there are no people working over there on a regular basis, and it's expensive, and the money is a problem, and circulation, readers, listeners, viewers, it's all a problem, and the money is a dominant value, we keep the money and we don't do the job.
All right. Beside the reporting of what's going on with the troops, you know, which people feel some value to, but are you basically saying that if you're embedded, that you're not, there's no value in what you've done?
Well, I'm saying there's a limited value. As I described, it's about, you know, you're reporting on what your newspaper or your station is going to want. They're going to want to know about who from your area, your circulation area, your listening area. That's what they're going to want to know.
Mm-hmm.
And, if you get lucky, you may be able to do something else and sell it when you get back home.
Right.
But basically, when you're there, I think you shouldn't kill ourselves and think that we're going to be able to do a real great sort of objective or independent job on reporting on the totality of the situation there. Because we're not. I mean, I've worked with enough editors over the years and enough people running newspapers and such. And when you're over there and they're over here, they're going to be guiding the direction of your coverage, and they're going to want things that are going to interest local people. They're not going to want the broad story about the people over there. They're not going to want to learn about the Iraqis or the Afghan people. They're going to want you to write about Americans who are doing these great patriotic things, and you're going to be writing about the great weapons that we have that never miss a target, when, of course, that's not true. Weapons miss targets all the time. But if you tell the American people that doesn't happen, well, then it justifies all kinds of activities that you can do and get away with.
Yeah.
Because you're doing your job. I mean, that's the reality
of
it.
Yeah. Yeah. And
I wouldn't mind going on one of those snowshoe dinners.
There you go.
I'm just joking.
We'll embed you on one of those. That's the only embedding. I got to interrupt you though. But I look forward to seeing you tonight. Well, I'll see you over at Champlain College, 8 o'clock tonight, Alumni Auditorium. And you've given us much to talk about too. I appreciate that.
Thanks. Warren Baker will be there from Champlain College, and I want to thank also Gail Stevenson of the World Affairs Council of Vermont, if I may inject that. She helped to put this together with Mr. Baker at the college.
All right. Don't forget you. And don't forget to thank the Academy. Okay. All right.
I think I can fall short of that.
All right. Lou Salome will be part of the discussion we'll have tonight about journalists from Vermont here who have done some reporting in war zones. It looks like we'll have a lot to talk about.